Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. When the 2018 midterm campaign geared up 10 months ago, discussions focused on what the potential impact of a raft of young candidates, including an unprecedented number of women, might have on the makeup of Congress and the dynamics in Washington. As the campaign grinds to its conclusion next Tuesday, the focus is on the linkage between overheated campaign rhetoric and recent acts of domestic terrorism and murderous violence. To explore the status of this grueling election campaign, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin, University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science David Niven, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Plus, this afternoon, we are in the studios of CET with 30-plus students from the American Government class of Harvey Lewis at the School for the Creative and Performing Arts, SCPA, and so they can ask the questions that are on their minds today. We can't take calls today, but we can take emails, so you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. Ken? Everybody, welcome to Cincinnati Edition. And Ken, let's get started.
Oh, great to be here.
With our typical question. Yeah, it's actually great to have you in Cincinnati and in the studio with us, not just on the phone. But can you get us started with a question, a trivia question?
Okay, the trivia question is, who was the last president of the United States born in Cincinnati?
Okay, the last president of the United States born in Cincinnati. And only our studio audience is going to be able to answer this. So if you've got an idea, keep it to yourself. Don't give it away.
And don't Google. Don't Google.
And don't Google. That's right. Yeah, that's right. This is not, Googling's not allowed in this. So we want to get started. And I'm going to ask various students to come to a mic we have here in the studio and tell us their names and then read or just tell us what their question is. So, Lily, you want to get us started?
Hi, I'm Lily Theaters. Do you believe that the recent attack on the Jewish community in Pittsburgh and last week's assassination attempts on current and former high-ranking government officials have a direct correlation to President Trump's rhetoric?
Thank you, Lily. Ken, let's start with you.
Tragically, I do. And I know that, in fairness to the president, his people will say that it's unfair to blame the president because he's always had that kind of tough rhetoric. The reason voters elected him in 2016 was he was not the compassionate conservative of George W. Bush or the soothing rhetoric of Barack Obama. He was a no-holds-barred kind of candidate. But having said that, to me, there is not a coincidence that when the president stands up and talks about attacking Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and George Soros and Maxine Waters and CNN, and then lo and behold, those people are in receipt of pipe bombs by a Trump supporter, somebody who wore the Make America Great Again hat, who was at Trump rallies, whose van was filled with anti-media, anti-Hillary Clinton and pro-Trump things. There has to be a connection. Now, we've seen political violence before. We saw the shooting, attempted assassination of Congressman Steve Scalise from Louisiana at a ball field in Virginia last year. This is not new to American politics, but you've never had a president who really called for refer to his opponents as enemies. The media is the enemy of the American people. These Democrats, Hillary Clinton belongs in jail. Even after a day after the pipe bomb was sent to George Soros, which was last Monday, on Tuesday, he the president, tweeted that George Soros is part of the globalist conspiracy against the United States. And so to me, I don't know, this is not a media bias way of responding. To me, it's a factual thing that how could you not see a connection? Now, as far as what happened, the horrific acts of violence in Pittsburgh at the synagogue on Saturday, well, the President Trump, you know, justifiably and commendably said that, you know, anti-Semitism has no place in this country. But at the same time, he will talk about globalism as opposed to him being a nationalist. To me, globalists, not just to me, but globalist is one of those dog whistles that inspires and inflames the right-wing, anti-Semitic group of politics in this country. So is there a connection? I think that when you have incendiary vitriolic comments like this, it can help but be connected to the person making those incendiary comments.
David Niven, what do you think about that?
You know, it's hard to make an argument that hate can be kept in isolation, that there's no contagious aspect of it. You know, I would compare it to, you know, the rhetoric of the segregationists in the South in the 60s. You know, they said hateful things. Did they inspire hateful acts? Well, of course they did. You know, they reached their audience in different ways, in some cases inspired them politically, in some cases inspired them, you know, to take violent action. And I think probably the sort of unseen story here is the degree to which this has spread, you know, that this reflexive notion that if you and I disagree, that we should think of each other as enemies. I saw a quote the other day from the Speaker of the Ohio State House of Representatives, an otherwise seemingly innocuous figure, and he was explaining their campaign tactics, and he said, well, of course we have to do this. You know, we're fighting an enemy, and by which he meant Democrats. And that, as a reflexive way to talk about your opponents, I think is a new element of American politics, and no good can come of it.
Howard, the reaction to what happened with the mailing of the pipe bombs last week, and especially the deaths in Pittsburgh and the people who are wounded in Pittsburgh, let's not forget them either, has been very clear. Do you think, given that there's this kind of violence, that this might be a turning point, though, that President Trump, the administration, the Republican Party may say, wait a minute, for whatever set of reasons, this may not be a good idea, that we got to tone this down?
As far as a turning point, I think you've seen a turning point to a certain extent among some Republican lawmakers who are condemning this kind of rhetoric. I don't think it's had any effect whatsoever, none, on Donald Trump, and he will continue doing it. I mean, this is a man, you all remember he was here in town very recently, and he, at that rally and at every other rally that I've seen on television, he has called Democrats that they are bad people, they're evil. The media is even worse. And I've been in these situations at Trump rallies where he works a crowd up into a mob. And they turn around and they start yelling at the people who are on the press riser, the reporters, the photographers, the people who are covering the event, and yelling the most vile things at them. And shaking their fists at them and spitting at them. And this is something I've seen happen before in American politics, because I've been around for a while. But it was not coming from the President of the United States. The President of the United States was not the one initiating it.
Can I just add one thing, expanding on what Howard just said? On Friday, at an event at the White House, the president, after congratulating the FBI for apprehending the person who allegedly sent the pipe bombs, he attacked George Soros, you know, somebody who received one of the bombs. On Saturday, in an event in Illinois, he attacked Maxine Waters, who also received one of the bombs. On Sunday, he attacked Tom Steyer, the billionaire who's launching the impeached Trump campaign, attacked him, and he called him a crazing and stumbling lunatic. These are people who already were possibly subjects of assassination attempts, and yet that did not stop the president for calling them out by name.
I might point out that apparently an organization called Bend the Arc has circulated a petition in Pittsburgh because the president said he wanted to visit Pittsburgh in the aftermath of these shootings, these killings. And as of this morning, over 16,500 people have signed this petition saying President Trump's not welcome in Pittsburgh right now until he renounces a number of things, and it's very specific. It seems to me that the pressure to do something, David, is mounting.
Well, there's pressure, but you know, let's remember the very central Donald Trump boast, you know, that he could stand in Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and his popularity wouldn't go down. Nothing in the past 18 months contradicts his basic belief in that sentiment, and I don't think anything from this past weekend does. And to add one point to Ken, you know, the president was talking that it was as if it was the synagogue's fault that they were not an armed fortress. So, I mean, there's no boundary. I mean, it is a world in which it's either the victim's fault or, the victim is some kind of, enemy.
And Kellyanne Conway took that a step further today in a tweet. No, actually, on Fox News today, she said that it's not about anti-Semitism. It's about anti-religiosity in this country and that late-night comedians make fun of people of faith, and they're the people who should be responsible. And that is the most remarkable blaming the victim I've ever heard in my life.
What is it that a president should do in a situation like this? I look back to 2008 and John McCain. And John McCain, in a town hall type meeting, was confronted by one of his supporters who kept talking about Barack Obama being a Muslim and a terrorist and this thing. And what did John McCain do? He said, no, stop. Don't say this. It's not true. He's a good man. He is a fine man. We just happen to disagree on politics. But I will not listen to this kind of rhetoric about my opponent. That's what a president does. And that's you're never going to hear that come out of the mouth of Donald Trump.
Think of Bill Clinton after the Oklahoma City bombing, and think of George W. Bush after 9/11. And think of Barack Obama after these countless numbers of gun violence. All three presidents did whatever they can to be unifiers in chief, which is exactly what a president should do. There was not that kind of unity and sympathy that I heard from this president.
Well, we have to take a short break. Before the pre-midterm voting questions with Ken, David, Howard, and the SCPA students here in the studio. And a special note, Ken, Howard, and David will join other political experts tonight at 7 at the Cincinnati Art Museum for a discussion on the midterm elections. If you'd like to join them, details are on our website, wvxu.org. Ken, before we go out, what's the trivia question one more time?
Last president of the United States born in Cincinnati.
Okay, we'll be right back. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In this last week before the election, one critical question looms: turnout. Which party and which candidates will be better at getting their voters to the polls? For insight into what might drive turnout this election, we're joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin, University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science David Niven, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Because Ken is in the studio today, we have invited a live audience of students from SCPA, and they're lively, to ask the questions that are on their minds. We can't take calls this afternoon, but you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. And Ken, the question of the last president to be born in Cincinnati. We had a bunch of answers. It turns out they're all right. But the first person that was recognized is?
My name is Mia Mann, and it is William Howard Taft.
William Howard Taft is the correct answer. And by the way, she wins a Ken Rudin political junkie convention pin, which is going gangbusters on eBay. Okay, so and I have another question. If anybody has time, knows this, but who was the last president born in Ohio? Now Taft was the last one born in Cincinnati.
Right.
Who was the last one born in Ohio? And they can actually, Dan. I'm going to be at Dan's house after the show. Come over and we can discuss it, and we can get the prize if we don't have time in this week's show.
Okay. Before we were able to break in that last segment, there was another question that I wanted to get in. And say your name. Give us the question.
My name is Henry Dowd Warner. So as you guys were just talking about the effects of like hatred and in the media and the political campaigns, you can't talk about that without bringing up censorship. So I was wondering, how do you feel about someone's social media presence being censored for being too radical, such as Alex Jones?
Okay. I mean, this is social media is changing everything this election.
I think the issue that comes up is the intersection between this rhetoric and threats. You know, I think that just the sharing of information, or in greater quantities, misinformation, is pretty freely shared. But where, you know, where these social media companies get pressed, and you can see this including with the pipe bomber, when there are folks out there issuing threats on their platform, what are they doing but providing a forum to spread, you know, rhetoric of violence and to, you know, in fact actually inhibit speech, you know, because if I'm going to use social media as a means to threaten, you know, somebody else, you know, George Soros or anyone, then I'm not actually spreading speech. I'm trying to inhibit the grander exchange of ideas.
Henry asks a very important question, because it's not an easy answer, because one person's hateful rhetoric could be one's right to free speech, and that has not been answered in detail. But I do know that once upon a time, the hateful rhetoric about blacks and Jews and gays and Muslims and things like that were on the far extremes. The people, you know, people who did that were ignored by the mainstream media. Now they're on talk shows. Now
they're in Congress.
In Congress. Yeah. They're part of the establishment. That is startling. I decided the other day to look up an awful word for Jews on Twitter, and I must have seen hundreds of references to this word, something I never thought I'd ever see in print, and yet it was everywhere. So it's just remarkable what's happened. But the answer is still a fundamental tough one, because, as I said, one person's hate could be another person's right to free speech. It's not an easy question to answer.
It's very difficult to answer, because, number one, if you look at something like Facebook, essentially that's a private enterprise. That's not a public utility. That's Zuckerberg owns that. And, you know, it's up to him and up to the people who run that organization what they will allow and what they will not allow. Fortunately, on Facebook, there are nice little buttons where you can block people. And I use it frequently. And I use it when it is hate speech that I'm seeing pop up, and I'm not going to have it on my Facebook page. So that person's immediately blocked, and their comments are deleted. So, you know, we have some control, but I think Ken's exactly right that it's not just the social media anymore. It's pervasive in day-to-day conversations. It's pervasive in political speech. And it didn't used to be that way. I mean, you would be ostracized as a political figure if you spoke that way.
Kevin McCarthy, who's the House Majority Leader, wrote this in a tweet last Monday. "We cannot allow Soros, Steyer, and Bloomberg to buy this election. It just so happens, I don't know if it's a coincidence, but all three happen to be millionaire, billionaire Jews."
Right.
Now,
2 cent pipe bombs.
What?
And 2 were sent
pipe
bombs.
Yeah, 2 were sent pipe bombs. Now, he deleted the tweet the next day, but this is the House Majority Leader, who may well be the next speaker should the Republicans retain control of the House. So it's not only in the extremes and the far reaches of the universe, it's in mainstream public life as well.
Okay, I want to move us to a little bit slightly different topic. And we have another question from our SCPA students.
I'm Mavera Coltabina. My question is, what do you feel is the biggest reason why some people refrain from getting involved with the election and voting in general? And how is it important for each of the major parties to activate their base?
So
that's a great. The reason I love that question is because every time an election goes not the way you would like, let's just say Democrats, for example, in 2016 were so bummed that Hillary Clinton, whom they thought would win, didn't win. Donald Trump won, and they vowed, "I am not going to sit home this time. I'm going to make sure I'm energized and excited about it." And yet, when you read that, well, maybe your votes don't count. Like in Georgia, 53,000 people who registered, mostly African Americans, their registration is now in jeopardy because the Secretary of State, who happens to be the Republican candidate for governor, is holding up these registered voters from voting. And if you think that your vote doesn't count, if it doesn't matter, if you think that the Russians or whomever is sabotaging the election, people start to say, well, you know something, my vote won't count. You know, it's the whole system is corrupt, and I won't vote. And that's the biggest fear.
We've been through this in Ohio on a number of occasions because of laws that were passed by the legislature. Republicans in the legislature were blamed for voter suppression. Now, you can argue all day long whether or not that's true, but you can look at the voting in the 2016 election in the presidential race in Ohio, and you can see in heavily African-American areas of Northeast Ohio, Cleveland area, where there was a huge drop-off in voting. And there had to be a reason for that, and part of that reason, I contend, was that people were starting to lose faith in the system, that the system was working against them. Somehow, we have to find a way to restore that.
In fairness to the Republicans, could you also make the case that Barack Obama inspired voters in 2008 and 2012
absolutely.
Far more so than Hillary Clinton in 2016?
No question about it, he did, and that was a big part of it. But to me, looking at the raw numbers, it doesn't account for all of it. There was a drop-off, period.
I think to reinforce Mavira's question is that it's really framed about people who are reluctant to become involved. And that's not just the structural part of what government is doing to exclude, but also I think people's own sense of do they have a place in this election process. And I think it may link to what we were talking about the first part, our first segment, which is the language and the rhetoric has gotten so terrible that people don't see politics as a pursuit they want to be involved with.
A lot of people think that negative campaigning is if a Democrat attacks a Republican with negative campaigning, you think, well, maybe that'll help the Democrat. What it really does, it disillusions the party getting attacked. And so I've seen many instances of voters staying home because the rhetoric gets so ugly.
Okay.
That's an important question.
Another question.
Hello, my name is Abby Draith, and my question is, many people believe that the reason Donald Trump was elected president was a lack of young voters going to the polls or registering to vote. Do you think there would be an increase of younger voters for the midterm elections, and if so, could a blue wave occur?
Well, Howard, what do you think?
There could be, but I haven't seen any evidence of it yet. I see more people registering to vote. I don't necessarily know that they're young people because that's one thing that you don't have to put on a registration form is how old you are. And I think there's enormous power in the 18 to 24-year-olds if, in fact, they did vote. And this has been a problem not just in 2016.
Since they lowered the voting age in 1971.
Ever since that took place. It's always been a problem. And that has always been the lowest voting block of any age group. You know, the people like in my age group, they go out and vote.
Is that old?
That's old.
That's just old.
Very old. But, yeah, I mean, but we vote.
Plus the fact that you're going to get a much smaller turnout in the midterm election than you do in a presidential campaign, and
see,
that is always the case.
One thing that I don't often quote Jerry Springer, but Jerry Springer said, I was with him one time at UC when he was talking to a group in Tangeman Hall, a group of college students, you know, not much older than yourselves, and he was making a point about. He says, you people, you don't understand. You keep telling me that you don't understand why politicians don't listen to you. They don't pay any attention to your needs, like student loans and other, you know, issues that are important to young people. The reason they don't is because you don't vote. They pay attention to your parents, They pay attention to your grandparents. And why do they do that? Because they vote. Politicians respond to people who vote. If young people in America, and this was Jerry's theory, and he's absolutely right, if young people in America stood up, organized, went out, registered, and actually voted, because it's really easy to do now. You can, you know, you've got early voting and do it, you know, by mail or at the Board of Elections early. They could have enormous power.
Remember what the kids said in Parkland, Florida, right after the horrific shooting there? Yeah. They said, okay, we're not going to sit back any longer. We are going to take action. They marched to Tallahassee to get a more stringent gun control bill, and they promised to vote. Whether that promise becomes true, obviously we'll see on Tuesday.
And they marched in a whole lot of other cities, including this one, right, on the same cause.
Leah, I want to broaden out this question of who votes and what it takes to get people voting. So would you share a question?
Hello, my name is Jalaysia Bell, and my question is, how do you feel the Me Too movement will activate voters and influence the election results next Tuesday?
David?
The short answer is anything that moves you is critical in a midterm. I mean, so many folks are going to sit home, and what moves you? Trump is critical to the midterm. In that, if he can, whether it's in a positive way or a negative way, if he can move you to say this is important, turnout goes up. If a movement among folks who feel like they have a moment to assert their relevance, a moment to assert justice, if that moves them, it's critical to a midterm. I mean, think about what a midterm election represents. There's no headline act. There's no presidential campaign. For a lot of voters, these are candidates they don't spend a lot of time thinking about. Maybe they don't know very well. So where it matters is, here's a reason. Here's a specific reason why I want my first chance to have my voice heard. And you know, Howard's mentioned, maybe is there a blue wave or is there not a blue wave? Well, we know there's an awful lot of voters out there who are desperate to have their first chance to cast a vote since the 2016 election. So I think it fits into that context. You know, we mentioned at the very beginning of the show, unprecedented number of women running for office, which plays into your question. Again, people running inspired by this moment, in some cases inspired in a negative way, but inspired to do something about it. And I think that's the critical element right here.
But if I'm thinking of the most significant person in the Me Too movement, at least in the last couple of months, I think of Christine Blasey Ford, who came to her own great expense and humiliation, she came forward with charges against Brett Kavanaugh that were basically denounced and ridiculed by the Republicans. Donald Trump had a rally where he mocked her. So you think of the Me Too movement as being really significant in 2018 politics. You think of what happened to Ms. Ford, Dr. Ford, and how she was treated regarding the Kavanaugh decision. And if, in fact, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings seemed to energize a lot more Republicans, saying that these were unfounded charges. So it does play both ways.
In fact, I think we have a question right up that alley.
All right. So, hi, I'm Leah Hartman, and my question is, do you think that the recent confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh will have a strong influence of the results of the midterm election?
You know, there is a very well-known Republican political strategist in Ohio that I talked to a few weeks ago about that subject, and, of course, he was making the argument that, as Ken mentioned, the Republicans got all fired up after Kavanaugh was confirmed, and you know they were feeling like you know they're charged up, ready to go. They're going to turn this blue wave into a red wave. And there are still, though, people who look at it and say the Me Too movement is real and it is substantial, and it is going to make a difference. There's one of two things is going to happen. Either those Republicans who are happy about how the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings turned out are going to turn out in massive numbers, or the people who are disgusted by how she was treated and how Donald Trump denigrated her and the whole process. And that it's either going to be gender politics or it's going to be partisan politics. And whichever, if it's partisan politics, then the Republicans win. If it's gender politics, the Democrats win.
But let's not forget that Donald Trump won 52% of the white women's vote in 2016. So,
but
so
that was then.
That was then. That was exactly right.
Right.
Just before we take a break, I have one final comment about this whole question of turnout and midterm elections. Just some data. Here in Hamilton County, where we are in Cincinnati, in 2008, 70.7% of the people voted. In the midterm, in 2010, 51.2% voted. In 2012, 74% of people voted. In 2014, only 45.1% voted. And in 2016, 71% voted. The midterm, if you do vote, your vote counts even more because the tendency is for a really significant drop-off, and it's an important thing to remember. So we have to take a break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7. After the break, more questions from our SCPA students. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The countdown to November 6th is on, and the intensity is ratcheted up on the campaign trail. What are the issues and trends that will determine the outcome of this year's critical midterms? Joining us in the studios here at WCET, at CET, this afternoon are political junkie Ken Rudin, University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science David Niven, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson, and most importantly, 30-plus students from SCPA. We can't take calls today, but you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. So I want to get as many questions in here as possible, and we have someone ready to go. Let's have your name and the question.
Yeah, hello, I'm Robert Jost. If there happens to be a blue wave, do you think that it would further divide Republicans and Democrats or possibly bring in more Republicans that voted Republican in 2016 more to the left?
Yeah.
I think no matter what happens, Republicans will move further to the right, Democrats will move further to the left. I think Robert, you know, it's an important question, but because remember when Donald Trump was asked prior to the 2016 election if he would accept the results, he wouldn't say yes because he said it's rigged. And so if the Republicans had lost in 2016, a lot of would have blamed it on a rigged system. Donald Trump is already talking about how the media are trying to rig the midterm, 2018 midterms. So I think that if the Democrats do win the House, which I think they will, I think that it'll be, remember when Donald Trump talked about the 4 million illegal votes in California that put Hillary Clinton gave her the popular vote lead? I think the Republicans may very well blame the Democrats and fake votes and dishonest votes for that. They may not even accept the decision.
But in terms of where a win would come from, I mean, it would come from enthusiasm among Democratic voters just outperforming, you know, as Dan mentioned earlier, those low numbers of turnout in midterm elections, outperforming those numbers, you know, from the excitement. I mean, that's where this is going to come from. It's not going to come from a mass wave of defections. Anybody who doesn't want to be a Republican is already defected.
The political divide is just too deep anymore to see too many people crossing party lines and, you know, Democrats becoming Republicans and Republicans becoming Democrats. If Democrats win the House, they can obviously do a lot to put the brakes on Donald Trump and his legislative plans. What's that going to do? Well, that's just going to probably enrage him. He's always in some kind of rage, but he'll be in a bigger rage if that happens. And so will his supporters. And so will a lot of the Republicans in Congress. So the gulf will just keep growing. But at least the Democrats will have a foothold in the power structure.
We had a email that I think is worth noting at this point. And it says, we have no hope of a more moderate government because those candidates are not nominated by their parties. So it sort of gets back to both parties moving to their extremes, and the moderates are having trouble even getting the primary election.
I mean, think of Dianne Feinstein in California. Ever since she's been in the Senate since 1992, she's always talked about working across party aisles. When Donald Trump was elected, she said, "I would like to work with him when he's right." She's been booed by her own Democratic Party in California. She was unendorsed by the Democratic Party in favor of her more progressive rival. And so Democrats and Republicans, both of whom, if they try to become centrist or work across party lines, they get challenged and often defeated in the primaries by the more extreme elements of both the left and right.
But you have the winner of the coveted Ken Rudin Political Junkie Medal, who's back up at the microphone. Mia Mann, can you tell us your question?
All right. So there has been a lot of talk about the political swing. Considering the more conservative representatives currently in office, do you think it's likely for the tide to swing back to liberal, or do you think things will stay as is or even get more extreme?
Here's a perfect example. When Richard Nixon won 49 states in 1972, everybody said, oh, the Republican Party will dominate politics forever. 2 years later came Watergate and a big Democratic resurgence. When Bill Clinton won in 1992 with women and African Americans and labor and young people, 2 years later was the Gingrich Revolution. And so that Clinton Revolution only lasted 2 years at least before the 94 Gingrich comeback. So, you know, right now we think that, oh, my God, we don't know what's going to happen. That part of the country is moving far to the right. The rhetoric and the vitriol is getting really more incendiary every second. But something could change. I mean, God forbid another 9/11. But even 9/11, when you think of 9/11 and everybody said, okay, this is getting out of hand, we need to come together, that lasted 6 months. In the next election, there was, you backed the terrorists. So,
well, it lasted 6 months for an election. It lasted 17 years for a war, though.
So. That's true, too.
That's true. Yeah.
I'm less optimistic about coming to terms, coming to sanity in this day and age than I've ever have in my years of following politics.
Wow.
That's exciting. That's an uplifting thought.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I agree up to a certain extent, although I still think there is a possibility and it's, we've seen it over the years, in the history of this country, that the pendulum swings because of events, because of things that no politician can control, and things change, and parties change. And I still think that there's something else around the bend, but we don't know what it is, and I wouldn't even hazard a guess. But the one thing I have learned about politics in all these years is it never stays the same. It's a constantly changing, constantly evolving beast.
Think of all the Obama voters in Ohio who voted for Trump. From 2012 to 2016, that's a pretty dramatic
that's right.
Switch. Yeah.
But think about this idea that we're at this incredible point of division. In the lives of these students, no presidential candidate has received 53% of the vote.
Yeah.
So for this notion that, you know, we have all these swings, there's swings within the very, very narrow margin.
True.
Which means that these students and their cohorts can be the difference in the long run.
Well, it means that absolutely, with generational change, it does not take very much to tilt the balance at all.
Right. And we have another question sort of about the implications of what the outcome of this election will bring. So give us your name.
Hi, my name is Mihaela Marshall, and my question is, if the Republicans maintain 50 members in the Senate, how do you think Kavanaugh's confirmation will affect Trump's future appointments?
So this is on the judiciary. And President Trump's administration has been very effective at getting conservative judges appointed and approved, not just on the Supreme Court, but on the appeals and the district court. So the question is, will that just strengthen?
Well, this has been the central, you know, success of the presidency in terms of their objectives. I mean, they've run the confirmation process closer to an actual well-oiled machine than any other aspect of what they do. The difference, though, even if they hold the Senate, if the Democrats win the House, that comes with control of every committee, and that comes with committees have subpoena power. That comes then with the ability to look into everything that the administration is up to. So they might be a little distracted in the next 2 years if the House goes to the Democrats.
But, yeah, but the good point that you made, Dan, is the fact is this president, as he promised a conservative judiciary, and he's delivered on that promise. And the fact that there's no longer a filibuster in the Senate, that as long as the Republicans have control of the Senate, and I suspect they're going to gain seats next Tuesday in the Senate, Republicans will, they will continue to fill these empty judiciary seats that will, you know, the true legacy of a president is what Supreme Court and the judicial system he leaves behind. Trump's big success will be in this field.
Well, the true legacy of a modern president. They used to, you know, get legislation done and stuff.
That's true. Right. But that's way before Howard's
right.
time.
Right, that was back in the old days.
Way before Howard was, yes. So, David, you teach at the university level. Young people who are slightly older than the people who are have joined us today in the studio. What are you hearing on campus as either in your classes or just as you sort of pick up the vibe that's on campus right now, all the way from how much support for either of the major political parties, how much just disillusionment, how much anger? What are you picking up on campus?
I mean, I think the sense of disbelief that you might see across American culture is particularly interesting among college students because their frame of reference is relatively narrow. So, you know, maybe they have the vaguest references. I showed in class the other day a clip of Sarah Palin speaking, and this was like a figure from the very distant past. So, you know, their field of reference is Obama and Trump for the most part. And so, you know, they don't have anything to balance that against. And I think they're, you know, a little bit struck by the notion that things are spun out of control and they don't have any field of reference to think how this will stop. Now, for people who are older, we have exactly the same feeling and just a different form of desperation than perhaps the students do. But know that there have been other ridiculously horribly challenging times that you can kind of put this into a little bit of context to. I do, interestingly enough, have a student who's an exchange student from Great Britain. And every once in a while, you know, she'll raise your hand and say, is this really what's going on in this country? And I'll nod my head and say, yes. Yeah, well, that's what's going on.
It's really happening.
Yeah.
So we've had someone email us and ask that leadership in both parties is 65 years and older. Let's be respectful to those of us who are 65 years and older. If nothing else, will things get radically different 10 years from now because these folks will, I'm going to add, retire. Emailer said, just die off. So so is there a prospect of a generational change here that you can kind of see because you can see who's coming up through the systems?
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, that's just the nature of things. That's the nature of politics. And they will. Now, will they be different? Will they be different characters with different values? I don't know yet.
We're seeing a lot of that change this year, but I think it's the Democratic Party that probably needs more youth in its leadership. When you think of Nancy Pelosi, I think is 115 years old, right. And I mean approximately something like that. But I mean, if you think of the Democratic leadership in the House, look at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the Bronx. When she defeated this Democratic incumbent in the primary, she's a young person. Think of Ayanna Pressley in Boston, a young person. The Democrats seem to realize that their leadership, Steny Hoyer, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Dianne Feinstein, they're well into 60s, 70s, and even 80s years of age. The Democrats seem to be the party that needs a youthful movement more than ever, and I think it's changing. It's starting to change this year.
Yeah. David, I see you smiling.
Well, I don't think Mitch McConnell is anybody's idea of a youthful and vigorous figure in politics. But I take your point that the Democrats have to offer a new vision, and they're unlikely to do so with a series of 75-year-old leaders. I mean, the problem the problem with this is, you know, who's left to lead the Democratic Party? Where will this leader emerge? But I mean, you do see in the hundreds of women running for office. I mean, you do see that there is another generation offering themselves, and it'll be the Trump generation in politics. Just as Kennedy inspired people to run for office, Trump will have inadvertently inspired a generation his own self.
There's just some amazing women, young women, relatively young women, running for seats in Congress this year. Just down the road in Lexington, Amy McGrath running against Andy Barr, former fighter pilot. And she may well win, knock off a Republican incumbent. And if she does, she is going to be a future leader of this party, period.
I know we're running out of time, but one thing to remember about the midterm elections, except for 2002, you have to go back to 1934, the last time the president's party gained seats in the House. So if the Democrats do well on Tuesday in the House, that's history. I mean, whether it's Trump or Bush or Clinton or Obama, that's exactly what happened. So don't be surprised if the Democrats do well in the House, it's because that is the historical trend.
And the surprise would be if anything happened in the Senate to change that majority in the Senate.
I think the Republicans gained the Senate gain seats because some of these seats that are most vulnerable are Democrats in North Dakota, Missouri, and Florida, and other Trump red states who are very vulnerable on Tuesday.
That would be a miracle.
We have another email from Kai, who works at the polls in Claremont County, which is just east of us here. Very few young people are volunteering, working at the polls, and wants to encourage more involvement. That's sort of grassroots. That's where you start. And as a high school student or a college student.
And you get paid, and you can protect people's voting rights by sitting at the table, not letting anybody get sent away incorrectly.
That's right. Claremont County, I'm not sure about, but I know in Hamilton County, they have a very aggressive campaign to have high school students and college-age students working in the polls. I mean, there are hundreds of them, and they're looking for more.
For one reason, because they understand technology.
They understand the technology. That's exactly right, and they can help some of the older voters who may not understand the technology, and that's their job. But it's a great experience, and Hamilton County, I think, has been among the leaders in recruiting young people to do those jobs.
And I would also just point out, it's not just inside poll workers, but it's outside.
Well, the outside, that's different. I mean, that's through the campaigns and the parties.
Right. I want to thank Ken, David, and Howard, and especially the students from SCPA. I would also like to thank CET for allowing us to use their studio this afternoon. If you'd like to hear more analysis of the upcoming midterm events, Ken, Howard, David will join other political experts tonight at 7 at Cincinnati Art Museum for a panel discussion. Details are on our website, wvxu.org. Thank you very much for being here.